Good day, listeners. Jonathan Darty here with another edition of the Pure Sex Radio program. Pure Sex Radio is produced by Be Broken Ministries. Be Broken's mission is to help men, women, and families move from sexual brokenness to wholeness in Christ and equip others to do the same. Today's guests are Roan and Eva Hunter. They're counselors and the co-authors of the book Sex, God, and the Chaos of Betrayal, The Couple's Roadmap of Hope and Healing. And in this episode, they share their histories of brokenness and the impact that this had on their marriage. Through the many ups and downs of their relationship, they gained many insights that they now share with other couples seeking help in their own marriages. To learn more about Roan and Eva and their book, visit sexgodchaos.com. For more resources, visit bebroken.com or check out links in today's show notes. And please rate and review the podcast after you listen to help others find it. Now, let's dive into today's conversation. All right, Roan and Eva Hunter, welcome to the program.
Man, thanks, Jonathan. We are glad to be here.
Yes, thanks for having us.
Yeah, well, I'm really looking forward to this conversation. So you guys have written a book that is entitled Sex, God, and the Chaos of Betrayal. And then you've got a pretty spectacular subtitle, The Couple's Roadmap of Hope and Healing, Recovery from Infidelity, Affairs, Pornography, and Sexual Addiction. I think you covered it all. Right there in the title,
We got all the Google search words. That was the main thing.
That's right. So I would love for us to talk about, what you've written in this book. But first of all, tell us how you got to the point of actually writing this book.
Okay.
You want to jump in first?
Sure. I'll jump in. So we have been married this year 40 years. We married in 1982. We were high school sweethearts and got married in college. And during college, just a lot of chaos in our relationship. It was intensity. However, we thought, wow, this really is love, because we fought well, we fought hard, and we loved hard. And we thought that made a good relationship. So 7 years into the marriage, though, Roan confessed that he had a problem with pornography. We had two sons at this time. By then, we had two sons. They were young, almost 4 and almost 2 years old.
Yeah, and as Eva said, we started dating when we were 15, and certainly the setup for each of us. I grew up, parents divorced when I was 8 years old, and I got exposed to pornography. My mother's attitude was boys will be boys. And I had two older brothers that were 4 and 5 years older, and we had porn on the bedside table. And this was back in the day, there were these things called magazines. Some of your young guys that are listening, they don't know what that is, right? Yes, paper and print. But it was bad enough. That hooked me just early on. And then, I very little adult supervision, parental supervision. My brothers and I just kind of raised ourselves in a way. And so drinking was a part of that. The porn thing was kind of always there. And then Eva and I meet, it's a little town in Mississippi, that's all there is. We knew each other, but then we kind of found each other when we were 15 and started dating.
Right. And so my backstory, I did grow up in church. My mother played the piano for our little Baptist church, and my dad was a deacon. And my dad was an alcoholic. It was all hidden and secret. My mother did not allow alcohol in the home. So I came from a very rigid family system and an addictive family system. And Roan came from loose boundaries.
Yeah. No family
rules.
System.
Yeah. So, and we see that a lot in the couples that we work with, that maybe one comes from rigid and one from loose, or they both may come from rigid, or they both may come from loose boundaries.
Yeah. And so that was really kind of the setup for us. And we found each other, started dating. And of course, sex became a part of the relationship very quickly. And then the summer before our freshman year at college, Eva got pregnant, and we decided after talking to our parents to have an abortion. And that was a great tragedy and a lot of trauma associated with that.
Yes, very much. And we never talked about it again, not for another 10 years. However, the wounds or the trauma that created in me would come out sideways with anger. I really didn't know how to regulate my emotions. I really didn't even understand the roots of my anger. They actually went way back to what I grew up in, and then the abortion contributed to that as well. Then Roan's disclosure to me, and then that's another level of anger. I became the wrath of God, who is the love of God, but I had a lot of anger.
Yes, and even before discovery, and it's just, you know, now today we would call it complex trauma. I had my own from, you know, what I grew up in. It looked different than Eva's. And mine manifested in you know, medicating and numbing. And then the sex addiction ramped up, as it always does, escalated. And it went from, you know, pornography to strip joints, massage parlors, and then ultimately prostitutes. And I didn't grow up, I always say I grew up in the Easter Christian denomination. But I was ambushed by Jesus, my sophomore year at college. And then that changed everything for me, because, I quit drinking and I quit cussing and I quit smoking because I was all in. It was very real. And we started going to church, and we got very involved in church, and graduated from college and moved to Mobile, Alabama area, and then got transferred to Nashville, and then ultimately in Atlanta, where we lived for 22 years. But a lot of, well, those moves were all what we would call geographic cures, because my acting out is ramping up, and I'm going to, you know, if I get away from this stuff here, then that'll take care of it. And it was all hidden, and it was all secret. Like I said, we were very involved in church. We looked really good on the outside, you know, picket fence, dog, two children. And we were very engaged in church in every city that we lived in. And then it was 1990 is when I admitted we were having a conversation, and I told Eva I had a problem with pornography. And really, that was God moving, because I was never going to tell her. And I remember even thinking, who said that, right? I looked over my shoulder, because there was no way I was ever going to tell her. And then that really began our journey of even why we do what we do today.
And, you know, when he did disclose that to me, it was, I mean, just like this discovery of, I don't even know who you are, because of what he presented, as he really looked. We both looked good on the outside, for sure. I had my own brokenness. I really couldn't see it, my own stuff, for a long time. It took me quite a few years to unravel all my own, you know, coping mechanisms. For sure. But I was just blown away that this had been something he, and it unraveled. I mean, the disclosure, we call it a dribble or a trickle disclosure. Mm-hmm. It came out over the next weeks or months of all of the acting out behaviors. It absolutely did a number on me.
Yeah, so much so, the day I told her that I had a problem with pornography, Eva loaded up our two sons, that were almost two and almost four, and put them in the car, came home back to Mississippi. And all she knew at that point, that, you know, I told her pornography. And so I'm like, what's next? And I pretty quickly got engaged with a Christian counselor in Atlanta. And again, this was 1990. We had a wonderful counselor, and probably one of the best people even in the country at that point, one of the pioneers in Christian sex therapy, but not sexual addiction, because that term had not even been coined until the mid-80s by Dr. Patrick Carnes. And so we kind of wandered.
We did. And there was never, not a lot of help for the partner at that time. Very little help for the partner, actually. And, you know, the term then for the partner was codependent. And in the later 90s, mid to late 90s, it became co-addiction. I connected to those somewhat. I could see my codependency. I could also see my co-addiction, not to Roan himself, but more to the relationship. Today, the term is betrayal trauma. And I connect greatly with that, because what I was dealing with mirrored a lot of the PTSD symptoms, a lot of intrusive thoughts, a lot of hypervigilance, a lot of fear. It's just been it had been a journey for me to heal. Actually, I had a brain scan this past year, last August, at the Amen Clinic. And I no longer have I don't have the ring of fire, which trauma looks like a ring of fire in the brain. So I'm grateful for that I've never felt safer in my life. And that's I'm grateful to be married to a man who's in recovery and who is on it, lives a life of rigorous honesty, and gives back what he's been given.
Yeah, and it was a ring of fire those early years.
Yes.
We went to counseling. Eve at that point was just not having any of it, and we after 2 years, and it was pretty bad for those 2 years. We wound up and we divorced. But one of the things I think that Eva saw, I was committed to my recovery. I didn't just bail because we got divorced. I certainly stayed engaged with my counselor. I was in a therapy group with him. I was involved in one of the first Christ-centered recovering support group ministries in the country. And Eva, she actually saw the consistent action over time, even when we were divorced. And it was during the divorce where I think you would say you had your grace awakening.
Yes, I did. At that point, I was really on my own. I felt very much on my own. And even though we had the two children, but the pressures of life sent me to really begin to work on myself. And once I did that, I mean, one of the first things I did was get involved in a group, Adult Children of Alcoholics, and I became aware of what had happened to me. I really and truly did not think growing up in my home had affected me. My denial was very deep. And so that was the first step, and then I got back involved in just individual counseling and began to really work on myself and my own boundaries and just really figuring out who God created me to be, right? Mm-hmm. And who I was in Him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where my strength comes from. And so I became open when I could begin to see my own brokenness, was when I began to be open to reconciliation and restoration with Roan.
Yeah, and we were apart, separated and divorced right about a year, and then we remarried, and we certainly we made a commitment to continue doing our work. We often laugh. We'll have people that will say things like, you know, I tried that counseling thing, you know, 2 times, and it just didn't work. And we're like, well, we went 2 times a week for 2 years, and then we backed off, you know, to once a week for another couple of years. I mean, it's just this process, because especially, you know, anything of the sexual nature, it's got so many roots to it, and it's multifaceted, and then certainly how it affects the soul, as Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 6. There's just a whole lot to it. And, you know, we call it an intimacy disorder, and that's what we work with so many couples around today.
Because, not really knowing how to connect, yeah. Not really knowing how to be safe for one another either.
Yeah, it's like what is God's intention for marriage? What's the real intent, right? This idea of true intimacy. So much of what we work with, and just in our own journey, was this movement from false intimacy to true intimacy, the marriage that God intended for all of us to have.
So go ahead.
I was going to say, how did you start to turn a corner to where the healing that was happening in your marriage, you were starting to see that God was wanting to use that to then actually help other couples? When did that, where was that in your story?
Okay. That's a great question. I will be 60 this year. Rome will be 61 this year. And so life fell apart in our late 20s, early 30s. Okay. And so then we really worked on our marriage. We worked on raising our children for the next 20 years.
Oh, yeah.
With the mindset that we always wanted to give back. And so along the way, we were very much a part of support groups. We mentored other couples. We did a lot of lay counseling. We were really and truly, that was our purpose. We felt like, you know, the God had placed that. Yeah. We wanted to give back what we had been given, our own awareness, our own understanding. And around, we started our master's program in our early to mid 40s. We finished that around age 50. It seems like it's gone so fast. Actually, but we've been in recovery for 32 years. We started a private practice in our early 50s. We have 3 locations in the state of Mississippi. We've written the book. We do support groups. We do one-on-one intensives. We do group intensives. We're busier than we've ever been, and we're still in recovery, right? We're still working on ourselves, for sure, and working on really our connection with one another and our connection with God and with others.
Well,
go ahead, John.
Go ahead, Roan.
Yeah, early on, I think when I mentioned, you know, I was very fortunate to, it was one of the first, really, probably the first Christ-centered recovery and support group ministries in the country. And I was very fortunate to get connected with the guy that started that. Bill Morris was an LPC counselor and certainly a devoted follower of Jesus, and really wanted to incorporate, you know, just the faith aspect of being a Christian into the recovery process. And we just named our higher power, and that higher power is Jesus Christ. And so I was fortunate to get in on the front end of that, and learned how to do groups, and certainly how much it benefited me. And, you know, I think that's where, and then Eva got involved later with it. And I think that's where certainly our understanding and passion for like this idea of doing groups is, I believe it's kind of the way God intended us to live. This idea of life together, deeply connected, not just with a spouse, but with others and with Him. And so that's been just our passion along the way. And then certainly doing the, you know, individual counseling that we do, it's certainly important. However, we always say the magic happens when you're connected in community with others.
Yes, connection is the cure.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, because something, as you guys were telling your story, first of all, thank you for sharing that. I mean, you know, you unpacked so much over your lives. I wanted to ask, because I'm thinking of the couple that's out there that they're in the discovery phase, like of whatever the sexual brokenness is, or whatever the issue is that's really dividing them currently. But what I heard in your story was you had brokenness that extended all the way back into your families of origin. And there were other things. I mean, Eva, I think about the multiple traumas that you faced, an alcoholic father, an abortion, a husband that's, you know, sexually addicted. I mean, those are coming at you from very different angles. Rowan, you had this family that there was just no boundaries, like, you know, no structure, and then get hooked into porn and prostitutes and all that kind of stuff. Can you talk a little bit about what you learned about the things that you need to navigate for personal healing and the things that need to be navigated for marital healing and how there may be distinctions between those two things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, we always, in working with couples around this, we say there's no greater crisis in a marriage, maybe the death of a child. But when betrayal occurs, in whatever form that takes, the coupleship is at a major crisis level. And what you've got at that point are really two emotionally dysregulated people, because, like, for me as the addict, you know, I was using the addiction to medicate, numb, deal with my emotions. Certainly, I was unaware of that, but that became the strategy. And so, you know, the healing and the growth and the journey, so much of it is like learning emotional regulation skills, learning what it really means to connect, to attach to another human being. Because in my growing up, attachment, there was a attachment disturbance. May not have been a full-blown attachment disorder, but definitely a disturbance in the force, because the primary caregivers of my life did not know how to attach themselves. And that's not blaming. I'm just very aware of what they grew up in, the generational stuff that is all part of this as well. And so they had no model for attachment and intimacy. And, you know, they kind of did the best they could with what they had, which wasn't much. And so learning what it means to attach is a critical piece in the process. And just, you know, healthy boundaries. As you said, you know, I grew up with like no boundaries. And boy, that was a big learning curve. But we often talk about so much of this, it really is, it's skill set and ability. And these are all things that you can learn. It's much better if you're learning it developmentally as you're growing up, but a lot of us don't get that. And so to go back and learn it when you're in your late 20s, 30s, 40s, it's just more difficult, because it becomes more natural as a child, especially if you've got functional parents that are modeling it. We're much more like baby ducks than we realize. And this stuff that we grow up in, we just repeat it.
Yes. And, you know, for me to being able to really look at my little T traumas, my big T traumas, and to identify what messages came out of that, because those lies, the lies of the enemy, you know, I am not enough. I am on my own. Well, when conflict happens in the relationship, those messages get tapped into if they're not healed, right? And so then what comes out is a way to cope, whether we fight, flight, or freeze. That was a huge thing for me, to really begin to know myself, to become aware of what is happening in the relationship and what's getting tapped into in me. It was not the woman I wanted to be in how I was reacting. I wasn't responding, I was reacting out of a lot of fear. And then the marriage, we like to say we become one another's healing agents. Mm. We've got to know ourselves, know one another, in order to help one another heal, to have grace for one another, to be able to speak the truth into one another's hearts, really.
Yeah, and I think
we write about it certainly in the book.
Yeah, and I think
the idea of just understanding trauma, and as Eva mentioned, you know, those messages that are formed in us, Those are the lies of the enemy. Those are the toxic shame messages, painful implicit memories. It's the story we come up with. You know, children are great observers, but terrible interpreters. And so we come up with a story, and that story is about ourselves as a child, because it can't be my perfect godlike creatures, my parents. Something's got to be wrong with me. And that's where the formation of these false beliefs occurs, like I am inadequate, I am insignificant, I am insecure, I am incompetent, I am impotent, powerless. And that forms a belief system. And we can have Jesus in our head all day long and sing the song, but we're going to live out of that belief system until we become aware of it, and then we begin to put God's truth to those lies.
Mm-hmm. So as we think about the couples that are out there, that they're maybe they're in the early stages of just sifting through the mess, the chaos. What would you say to them as far as like knowing that there's a whole list of things that they're going to need to go through in terms of not only the personal healing, but the marital healing, all those kind of things? Where would you say is some of the best starting points for a couple that is, they've discovered the betrayal or the betrayal has come to light? How do you try to help couples navigate the first steps into the healing journey?
Right. So the first step really is creating safety for the partner who's been betrayed.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. what she needs to experience is consistent action over time from his or her partner. Needing to see consistent action over time, and that he or she is really working on becoming a well-boundaried person. Like, I no longer go here. I no longer do these things. I have filters. I have accountability. Just creating a lot of safety. So that's really the first step. And helping the partner to understand, like many times they have no idea, why am I reacting the way that I am? Why am I having all these intrusive thoughts? Why do I want to ask a million questions? It's just part of the process.
And that's all part of the betrayal trauma. And certainly when I'm working with the offender, the addict, you know, one of the first things I'm trying to get him to do is get plugged into a group with other men that are kind of moving in the same direction, and with guys that are further down the road that can be a mentor, a guide, a sponsor, whatever we want to call it. But that's so important, because he's going to need a lot of support, because at this point, his wife, and of course, you know, we're using husband, wife as the husband's the one acting out. I mean, there are wives that have done it as well, and the roles are reversed. So this works either way. I'm using the husband because I'm a man and I don't want to offend wives. I want him to get plugged into, to where he's going to get support, because he's dealing with so much shame at that point. And we say that, you know, the antidote for shame is chronic exposure to love and acceptance. That doesn't mean condoning the behavior, but it's certainly he's got to get that part of him, you know, loved on and accepted, and you know, realize that he's not in the boat alone. There's a bunch of us with him, and if he joins and becomes a part of the group and engages, he's going to have a whole lot better chance than being out there on his own.
Go ahead.
The same is true for the partner. I mean, I really encourage and provide support groups as well, because she's going to heal in community with other women mm-hmm. who are walking mm-hmm. in her shoes. Like, they understand her pain. They get it. Some of these women are further along in the journey. You know, it's hard, though, for the partner, because she may go to a group and get triggered in the group. She may hear things that she has not heard before, and she hadn't thought about that. However, what happens over time, it helps her become more resilient. and to begin to be more aware.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Brain so we've got research. A few minutes. We've got a few minutes left, but I wanted to touch on two other aspects to this that I think are really critical because they're going to always come up, and maybe even a third aspect that I think is really important, and that is the aspect of forgiveness, trust, and then really relearning or maybe learning for the very first time how to really love one another well. What is, especially with the issues of forgiveness and trust, where do you typically see that as the best time to start to really deal with those topics? Because I think some people try to put those way too early in the process, and then they kind of hamstring the whole healing journey. But then talk about how important forgiveness and trust is to healing. And then what does it look like on the other side of that to really learn to love one another well?
Certainly the forgiveness piece is just a critical piece, and the offended party has to at some point begin to work through to forgiveness. That is a journey. That's a process. That's not a I forgive you kind of deal.
Right, because there's a lot of impact that has happened to the partner, you know, that each situation will have to work through forgiveness. It's not a one and done by any means.
Right.
However, if a partner is willing to stay in the relationship, that's already a sign of, hey, I'm moving towards forgiveness.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Not there yet, but I'm moving towards it.
Yeah. And then on the trust side, the rebuilding of trust, one of the things, I tell men is, you know, quit asking her, when will you trust me again? When she's ready, she'll let you know. You can save that energy. And then what you can do is focus your energy on creating safety. Because I believe the idea of creating safety is a little easier to understand. And, you know, those are practical things like she needs to see it, right? She's got to see you doing something. And those are things like certainly, you know, software on my phone, working at my boundaries. You know, I'm active and going to group. I'm going to see my counselor. I'm building my team of guys, my SEAL team. I'm engaging in men's community on a deeper level. There's lots of things that will create safety, but it does take consistent action over time. And if we're doing those things, safety will occur, but it takes time.
Mm-hmm.
And then the love on the other side,
Yeah, the love on the other side, I would say that's the easy part 40 years in.
At this point.
Yeah. That's the easy part. Because, you know, what we're looking for in a long-term relationship is more of an abiding love and knowing one another.
Mm.
That we have no secrets, no silence, and no judgment.
That's
so
good.
It's more of an abiding love. And,
that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I really, obviously there's a lot more that we can talk about, and there's a lot more in your book. So tell our listeners how they can get more information about the book and then also what you guys do in ministry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the book is available on Amazon. You can just go to Amazon and be careful when you Google it. It's Sex, God, and the Chaos of Betrayal. And we also have our website. Our website is sexgodchaos.com. There's more information on there, some other resources. And then you can order the book. There's a link there to Amazon for the book. We've got information there too about some of the things that we do. We do couples intensives. We do men's intensives. I'm actually getting ready to head out this afternoon to do a clinical intensive for the Samson Society.
Mm-hmm.
We do those just pretty frequently. Our couples intensives are available if people want to come here and be a part of that. And we've had couples come from different places all over. We do one-to-one intensives where a couple comes in and we'll do either a two-day or three-day intensive, like three full days, one-to-one with another couple. And the great thing about that is you get to actually dig in and do a lot of work instead of kind of the typical hour-to-hour, you know, counseling model. Mm-hmm. It's very effective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Rowan and Eva, thank you so much for being willing to step into this space with your story and for writing this book and for being with us today. We really appreciate having you here.
Man, thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Jonathan.
We appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yes.
And listeners, we are going to put all that information in the show notes about how you can get their book and get connected with what they're doing in their ministry. But we're always glad that you're with us, and we look forward to seeing you back here again next time on the Pure Sex Radio program. Take care.